Gemara, but not conventional for the way a normal person thinks. That is to say, we have been learning for the last little while about Shabbos candles. To be more accurate, Shabbos lamps. They don't have candles on part of them. Candles is a relatively new invention. And the question was, how do you fuel the lamps? The lamps were containers that would have somewhere to put a wick inside. And the question we learned about in the last Gemara was, should it ideally be olive oil? Could it be any oil? Are there certain substances which should be proscribed from use, either because they have an aroma that gets attached to it, and this could induce violation of Shabbos, or because they're maybe more flammable than usual? We talked about the last week because somebody might dip their fingers in to take some of the aromatic oil and rub it into the hands. So it's conducive to violation of Shabbos, so we shouldn't use that. Or if it's off, or if it's flammable, then we have a problem. Maybe people are going to run away. Maybe there won't be peaceful and serene around the Shabbos table because they're worried about these lamps. And near the end of last week's Gemara, we made a statement. And the statement was that you should know, as a rule, that when it comes to using the materials to fuel the Shabbos candle, the Shabbos lamps, the Shabbos serenity, we made the statement about not using kol hayotzim min ha'etz emadlikim bay. If it comes from wood, if it's a derivative of wood, we don't use it. And that included sap and various kinds of fuel that can sometimes be extracted from different forms of tree life, you know, kind of like a resin that you could lift from a tree. So the Gemara, for all of its order, is not so orderly. It's like life itself, it meanders. And the Gemara now goes off really onto a totally different direction. We're going to be moving from candles into clothing. And the reason we move from candles into clothing is because since we made a statement of we won't use as fuel anything which comes from a tree, so there's another statement about anything that comes from a tree, kol hayetzim min ha'etz. Because there's a corollary between two statements of kol hayetzim min ha'etz, so the Gemara says, funny you should say that. Now that you brought up the subject of kol hayetzim min ha'etz, that which comes from a tree, there is another whole issue, another whole arena of halacha, which we're going to briefly discuss. And the Gemara kind of makes like an interregnum in its primary focus of lighting Shabbat candles and creating Shabbat atmosphere. And when we got there, you know, this is because it was a whole meandering long way from Shabbat candles. We ended up in the Chanukah menorah. From the Chanukah menorah, we ended up back at the Friday night table. And now we're going to end up in the clothing bin. On the bottom of page 26a, Tanya, we learned in a Braisa. A Braisa is a teaching that is really the same genre as the Mishnah. Why is that important? Why is it important to know if it's the same genre as the Mishnah? And what do we care? What if it's not a Mishnah? Well, it's very important because, like Maimonides, Rambam says that the Mishnah is Dvarim Rabim, Inyonim Rabim, B'Dvarim Ktzorim. A lot of content packed into very few words. So the assumption is going to be that the Mishnah, if it looks simple, is deceptively simple. And there's always more to it. And I have to kind of plumb the depths of the Mishnah. I have to carefully analyze every word to squeeze all the meaning out. So the Mishnah was actually inducted into the body of the six orders of Mishnayot by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And then there's the codicil of the Mishnah, which could be called Tosefta. There are various forms of Tosefta, or sometimes Braisot that were preserved individually. And the Chachamim, the sages, they knew all these Braisot by heart. And by casting the halacha of the Mishnah, and sometimes then comparing it to a ruling in the Braisa, we would be able to get greater clarity as to what the Mishnah or the Braisa might be saying. So the Gemara has only come to this because it mentioned a teaching of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, and specifically, we mentioned the teaching about kol hayetzim min ha'etz, everything that comes out of the tree. So the Gemara now says, Tanya, we learned in a Braisa. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, Amir Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, kol hayetzim min ha'etz, if it's a derivative of wood, of a tree, ein bay mishum shalosh al shalosh, then there is no 3x3. 3x3 does not apply. What does that mean, 3x3 does not apply? What's going on here? All right, so there's a little background that I have to fill you in with right now. And the background is like this. The Torah talks to us about clothing. And the reason the Torah talks to us about clothing is because there are certain mitzvos or certain Torah ideas that are related to clothing. One of the ideas that's related to clothing specifically is the concept of ritual purity or impurity. And this really comes in two flavors. First of all, in biblical and temple times, there was something called tzaras. And tzarat was once a part of our life. Anybody could get tzarat and you had to deal with it. And this is more like a religious obligation. It's not a contagion. It's nothing to do with any kind of germs. It's a paranormal thing. It's only for the sake of your eyes. It's like virtual reality. But a virtual reality that we believe had a spiritual origin and had to be handled a certain way. And there's ritual impurity that's attached to it. And once upon a time, ritual impurity was an important part of Jewish life. There was Beit HaMikdash, there was Kohanim, there was Levim, there was Truma, the various different ideas that we've talked about many times in these classes, where if you were impure, would make a world of difference. We don't have a Beit HaMikdash for a very long time now, 1949 years. And really, for us, it's like almost like talking about outer space. Like, we can't relate to ritual purity and impurity. It doesn't affect our life in any real meaningful way today. We're talking about something that was once very much on the radar of an observant Jew. Very much. Like there's certain things that you live with if you're an observant Jew or you're around Jewish observance. There are certain things that are on the radar. Whether it's honesty in business, whether it's what do I have to do to keep Shabbat, whether it's on my tefillin kosher, whether it's in my food kosher, I use the spoon in the wrong pot, what do I do now? It's part of everyday life. You have a kosher kitchen, you have shilas, things go wrong. Once upon a time, tumah and tara was part of everyday life. And tzarat was part of everyday life. So tzarat can afflict a person in multiple ways. Tzarat can afflict a home, and that has to be on stone, not brick, and it has to be only in Eretz Yisrael, and the home has to be a certain size. And then tzarat can afflict your Chesterfield, or whatever kind of bedding or furniture you have which is made of leather. Tzaras can affect your clothing. And finally, tzaras can affect your person. So we have these many different layers of tzaras. Because tzaras can affect clothing, the Torah has to define clothing. So what is, and when I say define clothing, really there's two questions here. Number one is substance. Can clothing be made of any substance? What was the name of that big rock concert where everybody got stoned?
Woodstock.
So some of the pictures I saw from Woodstock, apparently you can't look at all the pictures, but the pictures which are lookable, there are people wearing paper bag clothes. Okay. Is
during
that
the rain.
During the rain. Right. Okay. Is that clothing? Halachically. Forget if it covers the subject.
Well, it's not.
Yeah. That would be a question. Of course, in Woodstock, there was no question of tzaras. Nobody was worried about clothing altogether. So maybe that wasn't an issue. But if you were a halachic person, you would look at that and say, I wonder if that qualifies as clothing. Why? Substance. And then there's a question of, does clothing have to have a certain size? Does it have to kind of meet a certain standard to be called clothing? If somebody is not clothed and he grabs a tablecloth, does the tablecloth become an article of clothing? Or it's a fig leaf. You just use something to cover yourself, but really, it's not an article of clothing. This is the kinds of questions you'd have to deal with, halachically speaking. So, in halacha, we don't have a definition as to what is or is not clothing in a clear way, with the exception of the laws of tzaras. When it comes to tzaras, it says, or a beged, which is made of tzemer oy pishtim. Tzemer is wool, and wool specifically comes from the back of a sheep, not a goat, even though goat hair sometimes can be used as well, or it's got to be flax, which of course is vegetation that comes from the ground, and that's what they make linen from. Yeah, linen comes from flax. So we have either linen or wool. Linen or wool. What if you would have a cotton garment? The cotton garment could not become tummy with tzaras, because the only thing that can become tummy with tzaras is shasi, which is made, or ediv, the wrap or woof made of tzemer or pishtim.
Wait, like leather, because a leather couch could become
tummy. Yes, a leather couch could become tummy.
But leather clothing.
But
can't.
Leather, we don't talk about leather clothing in the Mishnah. Oh. The Mishnah talks about the clothing. When it talks about clothing, it talks about the ottomans and Chesterfields and things like that made
they
of leather.
Clothing in the,
it's possible.
People use the hides of
that. Yeah, it's possible. But that's not spoken of as clothing. We hear clothing. The Torah is very clear when it comes to clothing. We talk about wool and linen. Incidentally, there is one other time when the Torah talks about clothing, but not really, and that's about tzitzit. So really, biblically, tzitzit have to either be wool or linen. Wool or linen. And cotton tzitzit are only rabbinic. That's a rabbinic ordination. If it's going to be biblical, then it has to be either wool or linen. Now, of course, wool tzitzis are a little hot sometimes in the summer, and not everybody likes to wear wool tzitzis, so I get that. But if you want to fulfill the biblical mitzvah, it's got to either be wool or linen. And the interesting thing, of course, is that wool and linen are the two substances which now are mixed together. But that's a subject for another day. So we have definition as to what kind of material can be used. Here is the big question, and this is going to be a dispute of the Amoraim, the rabbis of the Gemara. Does that halacha that's clearly and explicitly spelled out in the Torah with regard to tzarat, does that apply to all other forms of ritual purity and impurity or not? You're going to say to me, I don't understand what you're saying. What does clothing have to do with ritual purity and impurity? Well, it does, and I'll tell you why. Ritual purity and impurity is something that can be conducted, something that can be, something can become, it can receive ritual impurity, and sometimes it can even convey, because it becomes a conductor of ritual impurity. The thing we need for something to be ritual impurity is that it be an artifact. It has to be some kind of useful artifact. In other words, it's not just about mass, it has to also be about the form. So if I have an artifact which was once used for a particular purpose, and now that purpose, it's no longer useful for that purpose. For example, I have a cup. And the cup is it's a great cup. It's a great coffee cup. It's my favorite coffee cup. But unfortunately for me, my coffee cup got a hole in it, and it's been leaking all over the place. So I had to retire my coffee cup. So if it would be ritually impure, once it's got a hole in it and it's leaking, it's not useful anymore, what happens to the coffee cup? It's no longer a cup. If it's not a cup anymore, then it can't become ritually impure. What if I can use it to put pencils inside? Oh, now you're talking. Then maybe it's still a cup. Maybe it's a pencil cup. So this is what's called a gizterah or a gezusterah. Whether you have a shard, if the shard still serves some of its original use. But the point is it has to have use attached to it. So when you look at a piece of bullion, a piece of metal, you say, what is that? You say, it's metal. It's metal. It's gold. It's silver. It's copper. It's steel. I don't know. It's molten. It's metal. But what happens when you look at metal, a metal key, or you look at a metal cup, or you look at a fork or a spoon? Somebody says, what is that? You don't say, that's metal. What are you saying?
It's the article.
You say, that's a fork. You say, that's a spoon. That's the point. It's not metal. It's a spoon. And because it's a spoon, it can conduct ritual purity and impurity. So cloth does not become ritually impure. A bolt of cloth doesn't become ritually impure. What does? Clothing. Clothing does. So what if there was an article of clothing? It's got a few holes in it now. Is it no longer an article of clothing? I know lots of people. I know lots of people who wear clothing with holes. Once upon a time, that was a sign of poverty. Today, it's a sign of affluence. People who are... I know a kid who got rich from taking a clothing and making holes in them and selling them. Quite literally. It's a crazy thing. He got made bullet holes in shirts. And he got wealthy off making bullet holes in shirts. And people are wearing shirts with bullet holes. It's like, okay, so the world is today a little, you know, upside down. Once that was a sign of poverty, today became a sign of wealth. The point would be, though, that holes do not disqualify clothing or make them useless. It doesn't make it useless. I remember as a kid once, I had a hole in my pants. So I said to my father, I said, Ta, I have a hole in my pants. He said, did you fall out? It could still serve the purpose. It may not look good, but it still served the purpose. So this is what we need for ritual purity and impurity. And the question now is, if you had an article which could be used for something and it became tattered, how small does it have to become for you not to value it anymore, for it to be valueless? In Yiddish, a shmata. Everybody needs shmatas. So the shirt isn't useful anymore as a shirt, but it's a good source of shmatas. It's good cotton. You can still use it. So at what point is like, there's no cotton left here? And here's an interesting thing. When it comes to people who are affluent, the Chachamim said, 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim. So a tefach is about 4 inches. So you're talking about like a foot, 12, a foot, square. A square foot. A square foot, that's still of some value. You could still do something with it. Less than that? That's nothing. It's garbage. But for people who are really poor, who use like shmatas like this for even three fingers by three fingers, it's not very big. But three fingers by three fingers
has value.
Has value.
Yeah, that's value.
You can make quilts out of it. You know, many tailors used to. They cut off these little pieces.
People sold rags.
And people literally made a living off this, of having rags, using rags. There are all kinds of uses for these little things. So it's even interesting how halacha could change depending on the circumstances, whether people would value something or not. In a wealthy house, that's garbage. In a house where, you know, people don't have anything, that could be very valuable. When I was in Russia, so I was like a spoiled American kid, so I couldn't go God to do it without ketchup, right? Like we had to load a duffel bag, there's no ketchup in Russia. So we brought ketchup. I'm like ashamed to think back how stupid we were. So we finished the ketchup, and like I'm throwing in the garbage, and the Russian lady from the kitchen is like, could I please have that bottle? I'm like, you want the bottle? Please, sit here, have the bottle. She was so happy. She washed it, and it was like, who knows? She's probably still using it. It's only 25 years later. It's like, it was like a squeezy, you know, and it wasn't a glass. It was a container. Right. I don't know what she could, the truth is, she was recycling, but everybody else was recycling. It's not illogical. Why throw the plastic out? Plastic can be useful for a long time. So one person's garbage could be another person's treasure. And that's all like kind of related to this. So the question then is, what's the modicum, the smallest amount of shmata to still be qualified as shmata? Well, shmata means tattered remnants. So there's two ways we say shalosh al shalosh refers to etzbaot. Shalosha al shalosha refers to tfachim, because one is masculine and one is feminine. So because of this, when somebody says shalosh al shalosh, you know it's talking about fingers. Etzbaot is a masculine word. When somebody says shlosha al shlosha, you know they're talking about tfachim, because that's the nature. Tfachim is not a masculine word, so you know shlosha, you'll know what it's talking about. So the Gemara here says, and again, this is a very cryptic Mishnah. Not easy to understand this for two reasons. Number one, you have to have background. The Mishnah doesn't give you the background. If you don't know what Shlesha Shlesha is, you're in trouble. But the Mishnah just says that. And secondly, you have to understand, what is he trying to say? So the Shimon ben Elazar learned Torah Braisa. Kol ha-yetzim min ha-eitz, if it comes from wood, ein bei mishum shalosh al shalosh. This whole business of shalosh al shalosh doesn't apply. Now the question is, what did Rabbi Shimon mean when he said this? Did he mean to say that the notion of ritual purity and impurity does not apply? And shalosh al shalosh was just a euphemism for speaking about tumah and tahara? Because that's the measure that people would use when they spoke of something ritually pure or impure. Or is he speaking about a certain halacha about the modicum size? Maybe he's saying when it comes to yetzim and eitz, shalosh al shalosh, small tatters don't apply. But if it's something larger, maybe they would apply. By the way, what kind of cloth, what kind of clothing could be yetzim and eitz? Very simple. Cotton, hemp.
It's not really a tree
cover. Yetzim and eitz is understood to be coming from the ground.
Vegetation.
Yeah, organics.
Okay, linen is too, right?
Oh, the chutz, very good, excellent. Chutz, but the Gemara says in one word now, but you have to have background. Umesachechin bay, and you can cover up with it. What does that mean? So mesachechin bay, think about this carefully. Where do we use the word mesachechin in the singular? What would the single word, mesachechin is a verb, and it's plural.
Schach
on the sukkah, excellent. Yeah. So what do you need for kosher schach? A, it has to be organic. B, it has to be einoy mikabel tumah. If it's mikabel tumah, it doesn't work. And this is one of the details where in today's day and age, you have to know the laws of tumah and tahara. And I'll give you a very simple example. Some of the sukkot, many of the sukkot today are covered with mats. The thing is that if the mat was made for the purpose of sitting on or lying on, it's mekabel tumah.
Right.
And this is a big problem because in the countries where they make the mats, they make them for exactly that reason.
No. The ones they're certified.
I didn't say that nonsense.
It used to be people would go down to Spadina and they would buy mats and they would put them on their
right.
Sukkah.
Right. But that's a problem because in Indonesia, it's very common for people to sit on mats. So what do you have today? You have a kosher sign on it, which means that you'll have a couple of observant fellows who are taking a trip down to one of these countries, maybe taking over a factory for a couple of days, and they're making the mats for the purpose of a sukkah, not for the purpose of lying on. In which case, it wouldn't be mekabel tumah because the intention of what something was made for will make all the difference. So what is the Mishnah telling us then? This Bryce is telling us, number one, if it's yaitzim and ha'etz, it does not have a din of tumah and tara. If it can't become ritually pure, impure, that whole notion doesn't apply. Maybe. We're not sure what this means. He should have just said, ein bei mishum tumah. Ein bei mishum tumah. He doesn't say ein bei mishum tumah. He says ein bei mishum shalosh al shalosh, and we're actually going to have three opinions in the Gemara what this might mean. But he says umesachichin bay, and we can use it to cover the sukkah, chutz, with one exception. We all know that every rule has an exception. This has only one exception. The exception is flax. Pishtan, flax, is the origin, the source for linen. Now let's take a look in Rashi. So Rashi says, ein bay mishum shalish al shalish. Says Rashi, lekabel tuma begimel etzbois. To receive ritual purity and impurity by being three fingers. Incidentally, here's another interesting detail where three fingers could come in. You ever been to a, what they call a chassan's tish? You know, before the wedding, you have to make a kinyan, you have to make an act of acquisition. So let's say, for example, we have the ketubah, read the ketubah, so here's the merit agreement, the contractual agreement. You know, Mr. Chassan, do you agree to everything says in there? And he says, yeah, I'm in. Very good. I have two witnesses watching. Now you have to make a kinyan. Now you have to do some kind of act of consideration to show that it's not just talk, but you're actually committing yourself. So one of the methods is something called a kinyan sudar or chalipin, where in which you lift up a cloth and you as if acquire the cloth, and in exchange for acquiring the cloth goes into your jurisdiction, so it's like an exchange. It's a chalipin. I take the cloth, and in exchange, I give my commitment. It's like the legal notion of the signing, the stroke of a pen or the handshake and so on and so forth.
In consideration of.
So the question could be sometimes, is it big enough? What if it's like a sashmata? If it doesn't have three fingers, it could be a problem. So some people are careful with what they do a kinyan with, that it should be mekabel tuma, because otherwise it doesn't have a din of a beged, it has a din of a thread. Right? So there are actually, for as much as it doesn't apply in our time, there are little times when this might apply. So Rashi says, "Ein be mishum shalosh lekabel tuma, to receive ritual impurity begimel etzbois." Now Rashi is deliberately vague here. He doesn't tell you what Abai is going to say, or Rav is going to say, or Rab is going to say. He just says lekabel tuma. He doesn't say if it's not mekabel tuma altogether, doesn't receive ritual impurity altogether, it doesn't receive ritual impurity in the notion of three fingers. He just says three fingers. It's not mekabel tuma. So now we know what this means. Yoytze min ha'etz comes out of the tree. So what are you talking about? What does this mean? So Rashi says, kigoin kamvus. Kamvus is canvas, which is made of hemp. Rope.
Canvas.
Yeah, as you see right here in Rashi. V'tzemer gefen. Tzemer gefen is cotton. Tzemer gefen literally means wool of the vine. Because cotton kind of like mimics wool of the vine, but it's cotton. And you can cover yourself with it. What does this cover up? Sukkah. He says we talk here about the booth that we dwell in during the holiday. Ho'il ve'no mekabel tumah, because it cannot become ritually impure. And now Rashi says, de'ein mesachechin bedavar ha'mekabel tumah. We cannot use for the purpose of covering the sukkah, for making a kosher sukkah, something that can receive ritual impurity. As we say in Masechet Sukkah, it's on page 12, that migarnecha umikvecha, that we learn this, that you use the leftovers of your harvest. So the leftovers of your harvest is that you have this silo, and you took off all of the bulbs, the seeds, and what's left? Now you have husks. So you take the husks and you use it. The mitzvah of sukkah is actually supposed to be an easy mitzvah. It's not like we in Canada are running to buy evergreen. You have to buy schach. Once upon a time, nobody bought schach. That was the most natural thing. That was the garbage that was left over. Because you took all the food out. So now what do? Now you take the leftover branches. The vine was cut. The grapes are already been used, they're turned into wine. So now you take the leftover vine, and now you take the leftover husks, and you pile them on top of your sukkah. It was a natural thing. It's actually in Israel supposed to be a natural. It's natural. You simply use, it's like recycling, you know. You got the food out. Now the payload that delivered the food, the stalks and the vine, now you put on your sukkah. And we know that's not mekabel tumah. How do we know this? Because grapes are mekabel tumah. And because bulbs, seeds, are mekabel tumah, because they're considered to be an edible, a foodstuff. And one of the categories of tumah is tumas ochlin. The notion that something which is an edible, something which is a foodstuff, necessarily can receive ritual impurity. So when you look at a bulb of wheat, you don't say, what is that? Oh, it's grass. No, you don't say it's grass. What do you say? Sweet. It's vegetation. It's weed. No, it's wheat. What's that? That's barley. What's that? It's a ground thing. No, it's not. It's a grape. So we identify it. It has a certain, people look at it a certain way. It has a purpose. If you see poison berries or bitter berries that nobody eats, somebody looks at it, what is it? I don't know, some berry, some wild berry. You don't look at it as food. But a person, how you say, oh, look, there's grapes over there. That's looked at as food. So therefore, it's going to be mekabel tumah. So because garnacha and yikveka is the leftovers of what delivered the food, we know from this that it can't be mekabel tumah. Chutz mi pishtad, with the exception of flax, the alfinon lekaman, that we learn later, the ikri eitz. Now, actually, Michael, you alluded to this before. You said, katna's not wood. And Ami was right when he said, yeah, but it's vegetation. It's true. You're both right. It's not wood. It's not really a tree. But it is vegetation. And sometimes the terminology of wood can be used for vegetation, which isn't really wood per se.
Although there is such a thing called cottonwood.
Cottonwood.
It's a whole different thing too.
Okay. I don't know what cottonwood is, but it's probably not from cotton, right?
No.
Umekabel tumas negoyim. Now here's the interesting thing that we learn later, that pishton necessarily can become ritually impure if a linen garment suddenly has certain kinds of discoloration. It's only when it's white. It's only when it comes in the form of red or green discoloration. Va'afilu unin sheboy. And here's something very interesting. How do we know that flax or linen can become ritually impure? Because the Torah says, if you have a garment which is made of linen, I would think, okay, a garment made of linen becomes ritually impure. What about bundles of flax? That's not linen. That you have to spin. You spin cloth. You spin. So it's not. Rashi says no, because it is the source of linen. Afilu unin shabai, even bundles. Kidlakaman, as we'll see later, and hilkach. Therefore, a mesachim buunin. You cannot cover a sukkah with flax. Why? Because it is the source of that which can become clothing, which will become ritually impure. So even though now it's in the rough, even though now it's not developed, pishton is the exception. And Rashi essentially is explaining to us why it says chutz mi pishton, except for linen, it's self-understood that you can't put a linen tablecloth on top of your sukkah and call it a sukkah. Nobody thinks that. But somebody would think that I could put leftover flax in its organic, natural state, and throw it on my sukkah. So the Braisa says, Mesachechem bay, chutz mi pishton. Rashi says, pishton means not developed a bolt of textile, afilu unin shebay, even if I have what's called a bundle. All right. Where would plastic come in? Plastic is not organic, so it could never be used in a sukkah. And it seems that plastic would not become tummy.
If they made the mats
of plastic
instead of bamboo, they made them of plastic,
you would not have a kosher sukkah. Nothing to talk about. Until plastic starts growing from the ground. It's not organic. It has to grow from the ground. It has to be like garnacha or miyikvecha. So you don't harvest plastic from the ground.
Well, you can make plastic out of plant material.
You can make plastic out of anything. It's still plastic doesn't grow. So it has to be migarnecho miikvecha. It has to be the leftover vines. The vines that produce the grapes, it has to be vines. It has to be stalks. That, yes.
And the vine has to be without any remnant of any grape at all.
Very good. That's absolutely correct. If it would have a remnant of grape, you would have a problem. Because grape is foodstuff. And foodstuff is mekabel tumah. But that's the point. Nobody left grapes behind once upon a time. just like nobody leaves their cart when they come out of No Frills, out of Sobeys. Everybody goes for that loony. Everybody puts the cart back. Do you ever notice?
Unless I've never had a loony to begin with.
Okay, then you for sure want that slug, because the slug is very valuable to you. I'm just saying. Everybody says, are you Jews cheap? People say, you know, there's a lot of crazy people out there. I go to them, last time I checked, everybody's putting their wagons back. They all want their loony back, you know. So the nature is, when you're a farmer, you got the grapes out, right? And what was left was vine. And that can be used for schach.
Farmers don't throw anything in, ever.
Right, they use everything.
Right.
Okay, so now what falls to us is the responsibility to explain this brisa now. We have a brisa. Man, this brisa is like, boom. Okay, Rashi did a little bit, just so we should know what's going on. But now we have to explain the brisa in halachic terms, because here's the problem. What exactly did Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar say here? Did he say that something that comes from the ground can't become tameh altogether? Or did he say it's not susceptible to a certain form of ritual impurity, or within a certain frame it can't become ritually impure, but in another frame maybe it could? This is not clear. Omar Abaya. So Abaya says, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, v'tono d'vei Rabbi Yishmael, amru davar echad. Abaya says, when I read this brisa of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, and I'm reminded of a teaching that came from the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael, I see one and the same. It's the same thing. Now, it's obvious that Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's teaching is not word for word the teaching of Rabbi Yishmael. In fact, it's very different. But Abaye was able to read into the teaching of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar and says it's ultimately the same essence. It's the same halacha. So the Gemara says, really? Okay, you care to explain? So the Gemara begins now to its analysis. The Gemara says like this. Amru, they said, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, which is that? Hada Amaran. That's the brisa we just learned. Okay. Tana d'vei Rabbi Yishmael, Maihi, which is the Tana d'vei Rabbi Yishmael? That's exactly the same as the Mishnah of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. And the Gemara says, the Tani d'vei Rabbi Yishmael, the house, the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael learned, Ha'il v'ne'emru begodim b'toira, because clothing is mentioned in the Torah. Now, when Rabbi Tanya de Yishmael, does not mean clothing is mentioned. Clothing are mentioned very early on. Clothing are mentioned in Genesis. As soon as Adam and Chava eat from the forbidden fruit, they suddenly knew they were naked and they needed clothing. The notion of nudity, people being uncomfortable with nudity, is part of the human condition ever since Adam and Chava ate from the tree of knowledge. They became aware of their nakedness. Babies aren't aware of their nakedness. The baby is not ashamed when you change his diaper. He doesn't blush. But at a certain point, children start being aware of the fact that they're naked, and they're uncomfortable with that. At a certain point, in halacha it says, a child, a boy is not comfortable when his mother sees him, or a girl is not comfortable when her father sees her. There's like levels of when they start become aware of themselves, aware of nudity. So that's really the origin of clothing. Clothing is a Torah idea. It's a godly idea. It's found at the beginning of the Bible. That's not what we're talking about here. Here we talk about the concept of clothing as they are discussed within halachic terminology. Not to cover the subject, but that something should be considered a halachic article of clothing. I refer you back to my Woodstock example of the paper bags, the paper bag dresses. So, or the paper bag shirts. So we're not talking here about something that covers a subject per se. Here we're talking about something which has a halacha of clothing. Where does the Torah mention clothing? The Torah mentions clothing a number of times when it speaks about ritual purity and impurity. It speaks about it, as Rashi would tell us, when it comes to shratzim. It talks about a beged, a clothing which is made of cloth, or a beged which is made actually of leather. It mentions this. It talks about it when it discusses the human remains and the ritual impurity thereby engendered. And it says that clothing can become ritually impure, but doesn't really say anything about the clothing. It just says beged. Just says beged. Doesn't tell you what clothing has to be made of or not has to be made of. It just says clothing. So Rabbi Shmuel said like this. The Torah says clothing. But the begodim and teira are said stam, without any kind of explanation. without any description, nondescript clothing, just clothing. And then, uparat l'cha ha-kasov be'echad mehem, by one of the mentions, only by one, the Torah goes into the details of what is actually the definition of clothes, what the clothes have to be made of to be qualified or quantified halachically as clothes. And what are we referring to now? The ritual impurity engendered not through rodents, not through human remains, but through the concept of tzoras. That there, the Torah specifically spells it out. Tzemer, wool, ufishtim, or linen. So Rabbi Shmuel said, aha, mala halon, tzemer ufishtim. Just like there, the Torah spelled it out and made it very clear that the clothing we speak of are made of wool and linen. That's clothing. Cotton, it's not clothing. It's not clothing. Are you kidding? It's a $1 billion industry. That's fine. It's not halachic. Halachic, when the halachas don't apply, we speak about wool or linen. So af kol tzemer upishtin. So therefore, everything follows tzemer upishtin. This is what we say in our morning prayers. We read the 13 principles, 13 hermeneutical principles with which we derive things in Torah. We call it a klal uprat uklal, where you have a general rule in the Torah, and then a detail, and then a general rule. We say, Ein bechlal av mashe befrat. The generality, the plurality of the subject will only apply under the specific conditions. In other words, we export the details which are mentioned in one mitzvah, and we equally apply it broadly on all other mitzvahs that mention the concept of clothing. That was the school of thought of Rabbi Yishmael. Not everybody agrees with this. But that was the teaching of Tana Dvei Rabbi Shmuel. Let's take a look in Rashi now. Rashi will explain this to us in a way which we'll really understand well. Rashi says, "The mehechi teisi l'Reb Shimon l'mu'uti shar begodim mituma." Where did Reb Shimon get this idea to exclude other garments from ritual purity? He's got to have a source for it. He says, "Oh, you want a ritual to be ritually pure? If it comes to the ground, it's no good. Where do you get that from?" It has to have an earlier source. And the earlier source, according to Abaye, is Hodetona Dvei Rabbi Yishmael. V'hilkach, because of this, Yoytze min ha'etz lav dafke. When Rabbi Shimon said, anything that comes from a tree, anything that comes to the ground, is not going to become ritually impure. It doesn't only mean that.
Not necessarily.
It's not necessarily that. The hu adin, the same thing would also be l'noitza shel izim, to the soft wool that can be made from the woolly llama or from a goat. You can make like a soft
down,
kind of a
down.
like a down. Yeah, you can create like a cloth. You can make fabric out of that. V'chol midi delav tzemer upishtin, anything which isn't tzemer upishtin. So in other words, he says coming from the ground, but he doesn't only mean coming from the ground. He meant anything but tzemer upishtin. Why did you use such unclear language if you wanted to say something? Why didn't you just say it? He said, because I was talking about two halachas at the same time. I also wanted to tell you what you can cover your sukkah with. So only when you learn Gemara could you understand this. You wanted to talk about what's pure and impure, but I wanted to put the sukkah also. So I made a law about purity and impurity because I really wanted to talk about the sukkah. So the sukkah can't be plastic. The sukkah can't be made of goat hair. So therefore, I use the terminology yetsa min ha'etz le'in sukkot sukkah nakat la. So nami le'in tumah. So I kind of, you know, the terminology went both ways. But really, it doesn't only mean coming from the ground. It means really anything. In other words, go back and now read the B'shim ben Elazar the way Abaye says to read him, the way Abaye says to read it. Tanya the B'shim ben Elazar, Amen. B'shim ben Elazar says chala yetsa min ha'etz anything which is not wool or linen. Means if it's not wool and linen, it's not ritually impure insofar as clothing are concerned. End of story. And now we're going to go into the next detail, the teaching of Tanit Bere Shmuel. So he says, Hoyov and Emre Begodim Betera Stam. Since the Torah uses the term clothing, but it uses it in a nondescript way. Kigoin, for example, Betuma Shrotzim. There are 8 rodents that their carcasses are considered to be ritually impure. If you kill a cockroach, that does not create ritual impurity. If you kill a mouse, it doesn't necessarily create ritual impurity either. There are 8 rodents. Animal carcasses are ritually impure. Kosher animals, if they're slaughtered, are not ritually impure, if they have shechita. Once the animal remains are developed, past where they're no longer carcasses anymore, they don't have ritual impurity altogether. Leather does not is not ritually impure. Animal carcass is. Leather isn't. Leather is the next step. It's gone through a major refinement process. So if you see somebody wearing a leather jacket, just say, you're wearing a carcass? No, he's not wearing a carcass. He's wearing a leather coat. If somebody's wearing a fur coat, just say, I can't believe you're wearing an animal. Oh, I'm not wearing an animal. It's fur. The fur is made. It goes through. I'm not saying I do or don't support fur. That's irrelevant. But the point is, I'm just saying the fur is no longer ritually impure because it's been developed. It's been taken from the state of a carcass. But when it's a carcass, it's ritually impure. Now, shrotzim, eight rodents, incidentally, we think we know for certain what they are, but we don't really have absolute certainty. A rat may be one of them, according to most opinions. So it could be a possum. There's a weasel. So these animals, if they die, they're going to be ritually impure. And over there, when the Torah speaks about this, and also with Tumas Meis, when it talks about the ritual impurity which is engendered through human remains, which means a corpse, or it could be bones, human bones. Or it could be, God forbid, plasma that came out of a person in the dying throes. Or it could be a limb which is removed even from a living person, Rahman al-Tsan. Somebody had to amputate a limb. There are various times in which human remains would engender ritual impurity. And when it comes to ritual impurity of human remains, if it's a Jew, it's even more impure. It's not only tumei b'maga, not only when you touch it, but also tumas oihel, if you're under a common enclosure, which is, of course, why Kohanim can't go to the funeral in a regular way. They have a special room built and so on and so forth. So when it talks about these things, it says, by tumas shrotzim, the language in the scripture is oi beged, oi oir, or clothing or leather. It says it. Says it clear. I can become ritually impure. Ubimeis, and when the Torah talks about the corpse, it says v'chol beged v'chol kliyur, any clothing or any leather article. So we hear about, for example, people used to have skins that they would keep flasks of water. They would go, a traveler would go, he'd have a skin. And the skin was very important. It was a very, very important way, like a survival thing. You could collapse it, make it very small, and you filled it up with water, and you put it on your back. That's how you got through. So people had these leather kinds of insects that were very important for people. That's how they survived once upon a time. So these things can become ritually impure. The chem b'shichva zera, there's also seminal material, seminal fluid also engenders ritual impurity, that it says the same terminology. V'chol beged, v'chol oir. It talks about also any clothing and any leather artifact. That some of that material is there. And then, interestingly, ubitzitzis, it says, al kanfe vigdehem. So the tzitzis have to be wool and linen.
Or linen.
Does it have to be wool or linen? Or could tzitzis be cotton? Can tzitzit be silk? Can it be made of anything? That's the question. The Torah didn't describe it, didn't tell you what to make clothing out of. It says, if you have an article of clothing, it has four corners, you have to put tzitzit. If I have a leather jacket, a leather poncho, does that need tzitzit? It doesn't describe it. It's nondescript.
If it has four corners, maybe it does.
Maybe. This is the question, though. So Tana Dvei Rabbi Shmuel said, the Torah talks about beged. Not in the narrative of Adam and Chava.
So the question is the form rather than what it's made of.
No. The question is the material that it's made of a material concern? Is that an issue? That's the question. We don't know. The Torah says, nondescript, a beged. Beged can be anything. But then, on one instance, the Torah spells out the material that's being used, namely, wool or linen. Ah, so the Tana, the Rebbe Shmuel said, you see, the Torah talks about clothing in a nondescript fashion before the business of Tzaraas and after the business of Tzaraas. But because it gets klal, and then prat, plurality, generally, nondescript, and then it goes into the details, and then we go back to the general rule so we can understand that whatever's in the prat, whatever's in the details, applies to the klal. And from here, Tana Dvei Rabbi Shmuel will say to you that when it comes to ritual impurity, the clothing will have to be either wool or linen. When it comes to wearing tzitzit, biblically, it would have to either be wool or linen. Incidentally, this business of whether it's wool or linen, there are many rabbanim who will tell you that if you're wearing tzitzit, cotton tzitzit, on Shabbat, in a place where there's no Erev, you could have a problem. Maybe you're carrying. Maybe you're carrying the strings. They're not required. They could be fringes. So many people who aren't careful with wool tzitzit on Shabbos will make sure to wear a wool tzitzit on Shabbos. Why? Because that infringes on Shabbos also. No pun intended. The point is, in Yiddishkeit, everything is like, it's all connected. Everything's interconnected. Every halacha has bearing on another halacha. This is the super highway of crisscrossing of everything. And ideas and ideals and jurisprudence in one area necessarily informs our opinion and gives us clarity in another area. That's the nature of Torah. It's like a body. The body is, everything that happens in one part of the body necessarily is going to affect the other part of the body. The Torah is a living, breathing organism. So that's the opinion of Abaye. This is how Abaye understood the words of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar was no longer alive. You couldn't ask Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar what he meant. All we had was a braisa, which was passed down from Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. And now the rabbis in the time of the Gemara have to learn this braisa and figure it out. What did Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar mean? So Abaye said, I'll tell you what he meant. He meant that the only time you could have ritual impurity is only when you have wool and linen. And there's two non-exact details of the braisa. Number one, he says shalosh al shalosh, which means fingers. It doesn't only mean shalosh al shalosh, because from a biased perspective, there'll be no difference between three fingers by three fingers, or three cubit or three hand breaths by three hand breaths, or a full article of clothing. It doesn't make a difference. The point is, if you say to somebody shalosh al shalosh, he knows what you're talking about right away. If he's a Talmud Chacham, he knows shalosh al shalosh. It's a rule in Tumah V'Tahara. It's a rule in ritual purity and impurity. Shalosh al shalosh. Oh, I know what you mean. Shalosh al shalosh. So shalosh al shalosh becomes a euphemism for Tumah and Tahara. When he says, according to Abaye, when it says, ain't by shalosh al shalosh, it doesn't have three by three, it means Tumah and Tahara. That's the lingo. So it's not only Tumah and Tahara. And when he says, Yetzim in Eitz, he doesn't only mean Yetzim in Eitz, it's coming from vegetation or organics or wood. He doesn't only mean organics or wood. He means really anything that isn't wool and linen. So why did he say organics? Why did he say Yetzim and Eitz? Why did he say that which comes from the ground? Chutz min ha-pishtan? Because he was talking about the sukkah. This is Abaye's approach. Rava, the protagonist of Abaye, sharply disagrees. Rava Amar Rava says, no. Shaloisha al shaloisha b'sha'ar begodim ika. He says, shalosh al shalosh, which means the smallest amount of three fingers by three fingers, does not apply if it isn't wool and linen. That's a special halacha by wool and linen. Wool and linen is considered to be the highest form of clothing and therefore has a stringency. Even a small amount of wool and linen, it still has value. But he says, other cloth, three fingers by three fingers, not. But if it's, you know, a foot by a foot, you have shalosh tvachim by shalosh tvachim, that would apply. In other words, from a Rava's perspective, you cannot say that there's no ritual impurity that applies. No. A certain form of ritual impurity does not apply outside of wool and linen. A certain form of it. Rava's reading it very differently. Rava reads into it in a much more precise way. He says, Reb Shimon ben Elazar said what he meant and meant what he said. As Rashi says, Shloisha. I missed the Rashi before. I want to just go over this Rashi before. It's a very good Rashi. So I can really explain it to you. So Parat L'cha Kosov Be'echad Mem, the Torah goes into the details about one of them. Betumas Negoyim. This is talking about the ritual impurity engendered with the paranormal condition known as the lesions or tzarat. So there's a klal tchila, a general rule. V'chagach prat. And then in specifics, which says clothing, is habeged. A article of clothing when it has a tzarat lesion. Kolal bebeged tzemer. First he says kolal bebeged. He used the term beged, which is an overarching term, a general term, a nondescript term. But then he goes in porat. He goes into a detail. So af kol habegodim hastumim. All of the nondescript article of clothing that is mentioned in the Torah. Yalfinan, we derive this. Bamem matzinu. Bamem matzinu is a methodology, a particular methodology. We say, well, just like you found it here, the same thing applies there. It's like a cross-import-export of a halacha. Dehu binyan av, the eini ela tzemer du pishtin. This becomes a general rule. Binyan av means a parent figure, a parent building. It means it's establishing a principle, a overriding principle. And the overarching principle is that ritual impurity for clothing necessitates the substance, the textile, which is made of wool or of linen. So Rava doesn't agree. Rava doesn't see it in such black and white terms. Rava doesn't say, no, ritual impurity doesn't apply elsewhere. He says a particular form of ritual impurity. Ritual impurity in the modicum, the smallest amount, doesn't apply elsewhere. But it does apply elsewhere. It does apply. Shloisha al shloisha, even b'sha'ar begadim, ika b'naya was the difference. So now, there's a difference between Abshim ben Elazar and the Tanna de Shmuel. According to Rava, for other clothing, the Reb Shimon ben Elazar islay. According to Rava, other clothing does become ritually impure. It's just the shleish al shalish doesn't work, the smallest amount. But according to Tanna de Shmuel, lessly, that doesn't apply at all. You understand? So this is very interesting. It's very strange. What happened here is, Rava says, We accept the teaching of Tanna Dvei Rabbi Yishmael, but not entirely. We accept the principle. Principally speaking, there's something unique about wool and linen. Yes, but it's not all or nothing. It means wool and linen is the only kind of textile that even a very small amount of cloth will still be able to contain and transmit ritual impurity. But it doesn't mean that no other textile is able to receive ritual impurity. And so from Rava's perspective, you cannot say they're one and the same. Reb Shimon ben Elazar and Tanna de Shmuel are saying two very different things. There's no question. What Tanna de Shmuel is very clear. He believed, Yeshiva Rabbi Shmuel believed, wool and linen, ritual impurity. Non-wool linen, no ritual impurity. According to Abaye, Reb Shimon ben Elazar and Tanna de Shmuel, Amru Davar Echad, they're on the same page. According to Rava, he says, no, they're not. No, they're not. He didn't say ritual impurity doesn't apply. He says shalosh al shalosh doesn't apply. That's fingers. That's a small amount of textile. So when it comes to a small, tiny amount of textile still having value and being able to convey ritual purity and impurity, that's where we say, yeah, it's got to be wool and linen. But it doesn't preclude the concept of ritual impurity from cotton, for example, or from canvas, or from blue jeans. Yes, these things could become ritually impure. Only they won't become ritually impure once they become tattered. So this is a braisa, and two very different ways of learning the braisa. According to Abaye, the braisa's terminology is not exact. It's more broad. According to Rava, it is precise. Now, it's not precise in the yetzim and ha'etz. Both Abaye and Rava would agree that if it's not yetzim and ha'etz, that we're talking about, you know, not only that which comes from the ground. But according to Abaye, the shalish al shalish was a euphemism for ritual impurity. According to Rava, shalish al shalish meant shalish al shalish, a particular form of ritual impurity. And really what this boils down to then, if you think about it, according to Abaye, he cannot see a distinction between a small amount of textile or a large amount of textile. If textile becomes tummy, it becomes tummy. If it doesn't, it doesn't. The difference in sizes will not make a difference in one textile or the other. Rava says, no, yes, it will. There's different forms of ritual impurity. Certain textiles are considered to be more prominent or greater conductors. It's a superconductor. He said, this is a superconductor. Therefore, even a small amount can still conduct ritual impurity. The other things are not natural conductors. It's not, you have to have a larger amount of it. And that's so far what we have in a braisa and in a Gemara that explains a braisa. Bezrat Hashem, in our next class, we're going to go back now to what Rava said, and the Gemara is going to say, one second, Rava, did you really say that? Like, but if you're saying that, why would you draw this distinction? Because A, B, C, and D, and Rava is going to have to defend his position. So it's a wrap. We went from candles to clothing, and we're going to be stuck with our wardrobe and stuck in the clothing store for a little while, but I mean, there is something called Shabbos clothes too. So, and we will eventually, from clothing, we will get back into the Shabbat candles, but that'll take us a little while.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm really sorry to tell you that next Thursday.